Rolls Royce. Yeah, man. Just give me a minute. All right. Are you a Coast Insider? Well, I'm a Coast Insider. And you can sign up to become a Coast Insider and listen to the show live. You can listen on demand with your computer, your mobile device. All audio streams are delivered in high quality, crystal clear audio. Those benefits include the last 5 years of audio archives. You get audio streaming or downloadable MP3s of archives, media access through the website or mobile app. You can chat with hosts and special guests. You get an iTunes podcast. You even get a direct email to George Inari, all for just 15 cents a day. Just go to coasttocoastam.com. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. Next up, 3 hours with the one and only Ralph Ellis. We're going to talk Jesus and King Arthur and a little Cleopatra the Seventh for good measure. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. It is Saturday night. I'm excited. Now, what you want to do, seriously, follow me on Twitter at J Church Radio, at J Church Radio. The reason for that is I keep it live to my left. And this conversation tonight with Ralph Ellis, it's going to cause a lot of phone calls. It's a lot of discussion. You're going to have questions. This is research that you've never heard before on Coast. Ralph is a first-time guest. Ralph Ellis has been researching biblical and Egyptian history for more than 30 years. Being independent from theological and educational establishments allows Ralph to tread where others do not dare. And it is through this independence that Ralph has discovered so many new biblical and historical truths. His websites are edfu-books.com. You can get there through Coast to Coast. It's very simple. And I would like to welcome to Coast AM, Ralph Ellis. Ralph, good evening. Good morning.
Yes, it's good morning over here. Good evening, Jimmy. Good to see you again.
Yes, absolutely. And now, Ralph, we've got a lot to discuss. And let's get the main thing out of the way. Happy holidays and welcome to the show. So that part is done. We've got a lot to cover tonight, and the Coast audience, this is the first time that you've been on the show, and your research is not only compelling, but it's also so important, and I have encouraged everybody to take notes, but we've got so much to cover, but the one thing that we're going to keep going back to tonight, and I don't want to confuse the audience, is we're going to be talking about AD 30, in AD 68 and AD 70. And it's important. We're going to do this all night. I don't want everybody to get confused. Now, how did you start to put together the importance of no AD 30 and AD 68 and AD 70 are the numbers we need to look at when we're talking about Jesus?
Yeah, this came about a long time ago when I started this back in 96, 98, something like that. And I wrote a book, Jesus Last of the Pharaohs. And the first thing I came across in that book was that Saul, St. Paul, just has to be Joseph of Arimathea. And there are one or two problems when you do that, and one of those problems is that the timeline has to move because Josephus Flavius wasn't born until AD 37. So, as a necessity, the timeline moved a little bit by about 40 years. But the correlation between Saul and Josephus seemed so good that I wasn't going to give it up. So I wrote about it. I wrote two chapters, I think, in that particular book about it. Because their lives are so similar. And one of the factors I liked the best is they both ended up on the same prison ship. So in about AD 62, Saul and Josephus were obviously on the same ship, which went, it was a prison ship. It went from Judea, it went up to Cyprus, and then it went down and got caught into a storm, and they were shipwrecked on Malta, and then they were all taken later onto Naples and then onto Rome to see Nero. Now, both of these characters did this, both Saul and Josephus. And it just seemed so obvious that they were actually the same person. And then that, of course, caused a lot of problems because people said, that's not possible, the dates are wrong, you're 40 years out, you know, the timelines don't match. So I had to then go back and revisit that, which I did about 10 years or more later in another of my books, because there are 10 books in this series. It's quite expansive. So I went back about 10 years later in King Jesus, and I researched it in much more detail and proved that this was so, that Saul, St. Paul, was Josephus Flavius. And Josephus Flavius, for those of you who don't know the first century so well, was the premier historian, Jewish historian, of the first century. He wrote all about that era, the secular history of the first century, and he wrote a complete Tanakh or Torah, the Old Testament. He wrote his own sort of secular version of the Old Testament as well. And that was quite pivotal because it changes the story somewhat. It changes the story because we end up with this chronological chasm, I call it, between the AD 30s and the AD 70s. And yet when I started researching this, there were so many other points within the gospel stories and other stories which seemed to back it up. And a lot of this has been known for quite some time by theologians. For instance, Jesus in the Gospels, he mentions the siege of, in fact, he describes the siege of Jerusalem. Now, the siege of Jerusalem didn't take place until AD 70. So they have to say, oh, well, you know, that was a prophecy. But in the Gospels, Jesus also laments the death of Zacharias Baruch, which is, again, a little bit of a problem because he didn't die until AD 68.
Everything seems to, right, Rob, everything is shifted in the historical record, this very critical, you know, 38, 40-year, I want to call it a delay. You know, everything was moved up. And why would Rome, or why the necessity of changing the dates to the story and to the narrative? Why was it so important?
Well, because it turned out later on that this Jesus character, he was a king, of course, as it says in the New Testament, but he wasn't necessarily a pacifist king. He was actually a warrior king. And it's quite clear from this link between Saul and Josephus that the Jesus character started the Jewish revolt. And this is the big revolt in AD 68 against Rome, which ended in AD 70 with the destruction of Jerusalem. And the pivotal character who actually started this revolt was called either Jesus of Gamala, or he was called King Jesus of Adiabene. And it was quite obvious to me that this was the Jesus character. So the Jesus character started the Jewish revolt, which is why it says in the Gospels, I think it's in Mark 15:7, I think, that when he was put into prison, it says that Jesus was put into prison alongside revolutionaries who had committed murder in the revolution. Now, which revolution was it? You know, if we're talking about the AD 30s here, what revolution was this? Because there was no revolution in the AD 30s. This was the Jewish revolt. And what's happened, why they had to move the timelines around a little bit, is because Rome was very influential in the writing of the gospel stories, because the gospel stories, as everyone admits, weren't written until the AD 70s. And they are quite overtly Rome-friendly. They are written from a Roman perspective. You know, when Jesus goes to trial, it's the Romans wash their hands of the affair. It's nothing
right
to do with them.
Right.
It's all those nasty Jewish people that did it. Nothing to do with Rome. And when Jesus earlier on in the Gospels is talking about the taxation system, he says, render unto Caesar what belongs to Caesar. pay your Roman taxes.
Right.
I mean, this is just ideal, you know. Rome loves this sort of stuff. It was really Rome-friendly.
Now, is that, Rome, well, does that explain one of the most important points of all of this, the lack of historical record in AD 30 from the Roman side, which kept meticulous records of everything, but he's mysteriously absent, but he does show up in AD 68 and AD 70.
Yeah, this is why nobody can find Jesus in the historical record. And we have this continually all the way through the Old Testament and the New Testament, where all of these very, very famous characters are missing from the historical record. And, well, you know, you've only got two choices here. Either all of this is fictional, and of course we've had a lot of books out recently saying the entire New Testament story is all fictional, or perhaps you're looking in the wrong era for it. And that was the result that I came out with, that if you look in the AD 30s, you're never going to find this Jesus character because he didn't exist at that time. But if you start looking in the AD 70s, suddenly you find the character.
Did all of the pieces quickly fall into place for you because you knew where to look and what to look for?
Not entirely. I mean, this still took, it nearly took 15 years because I got it piece by piece because there are various clues within the various books, and all of my work comes from the original documents. But they are hard to interpret sometimes because they have been deliberately, the timeline has been shifted deliberately, and some of the names have been shifted around a little bit as well. I mean, not by a great deal. So when I identified Saul as being Josephus, the main character that Josephus was, the main character that Josephus was fighting in Galilee in the AD 60s, the late AD 60s, was called Jesus.
And I want everybody to understand. Ralph says Josephus. We say Josephus.
Yes.
I don't want anybody to be confused here. So they fully, right now, yeah, they're going, I get it. Yeah. I get it.
In America, you call him Josephus, don't you?
Right, right.
Well, the name comes from Joseph, so I call him Josephus.
Josephus. Josephus Flavius.
It's pronounced in the Greek as Josephus. So this Josephus character, he was fighting a guy in Galilee in the late AD 60s because Josephus Flavius was the army commander in command of Galilee, and he was fighting against Jesus of Gamala. And of course, if we go back into the biblical record in Acts of the Apostles, Saul, who I do say is Josephus, was fighting a man called Jesus in and around Galilee. Hence we get the verse that says, you know, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? Because he was persecuting these proto-Christians around Galilee, ostensibly in the AD 50s or something in Acts of the Apostles, but it was actually in the AD 60s. And the Jesus character was obviously still alive then, because we have that from the historical record.
Right.
So that was the first indication of who this Jesus character was. But there is a further layer of obfuscation within Josephus, because this Jesus character ends up with two names. Because remember, all of these books were written in two languages, at least, maybe three. They were written in Aramaic, and they were written in Greek, and you get the two different pronunciations between the two languages. And so this Jesus character has a Aramaic and a slightly Syriac Aramaic from the Arabias, from Persia. He has another name, which is called Jesus. And that's the way they pronounce Jesus over there, because even today, of course, if you go to Arabia, in Arabic, Jesus is called Issa. And to be honest, this idea that his name came from Joshua, I think, is a total red herring. I don't think it did whatsoever. I think his name actually came out of Persia, because we'll go through this later. He has a Persian history as well. And his original name was Isis, which was the Persian name. And in Arabic, it became Issa. And in the Greek, it became Isis, which is how they pronounce Jesus in the Greek. And I think the Joshua business has got nothing to do with it, really. I think his real name was Isis.
Now, how much of this... Oh, I'm sorry about that, Ralph. I want everybody to know, Ralph is live from Europe, so we got a slight delay going on. But, Ralph, how much of this is, like, heretical? You know, how much of this is threatening? Or is the story nearly the same? It's just shifted by 38 years.
Well, it's certainly shifted by 38 years. That's true, and that's a little bit heretical to start with, because already we're lining up our pauper Prince of Peace character,
right,
who is now actually the leader of the Jewish revolt. So he's not quite the same character that he's made out to be in the Gospel stories. As I like to say, the Gospel stories are a true account of the Jewish revolt with fairy dust applied on the top of it, because they tried to divorce him away from the Jewish revolt. That was the whole idea of taking his story and sticking it back in the 1830s. Rome didn't want these famous characters fomenting revolts against Rome. And this guy was obviously very famous. He was very influential.
Right.
There was a growing cult about this person, quite obviously, even in the first century. And they didn't want this growing cult to be about someone who had just fomented a revolt against Rome. I mean, that just didn't suit them whatsoever. So, A, he had to be made into a pauper prince of peace, which they did, and we'll go through that later, how they managed to do that. And the other thing they wanted to do is take him completely away from this idea that he was involved in the Jewish revolt. Revolting against Rome? No, certainly not. Nothing to do with that. No, we'll stick him back in the 1830s, and then nobody will know that this guy was involved in the Jewish revolt.
Before we hit this break right here, I want you to take a minute, if you will, and explain this. I'm just going to say it. The conversion of the carpenter title that was tied to him.
Yeah, that's a good one, isn't it? Yeah, because, of course, he wasn't called a carpenter at all. In the Greek, and we really are working from the Greek versions here, that in the Greek he's called a tecton. And a tecton is an architect. And this is an architect, not simply in the building trade. He was a mason. Even today, if you go into Greek and translate tecton, it comes out with a Freemason.
Right.
And this is why we have all of the allusions here to stones and building technology, with St. Peter being the stone, of course. That's his title, the stone. In fact, he was called Peter Kephas in Greek and Aramaic, which means the stone. And there are many allusions to this all the way through the New Testament, and probably the best one is the raising of Lazarus. Now, if you look at the raising of Lazarus, which is in the Gospel of John, it is a third-degree Masonic raising.
Okay, right there, I got to jump in. We'll pick it up on the backside, because this is a very important point to take home with us. Our guest tonight, Ralph Ellis, we're talking about the true history of Jesus. From Ralph Ellis. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I just said on Twitter, bonus points, man. I will read on the air the tweeter that can name that band right there. Let's see. I'm watching. This is Coast to Coast AM. All right. Paranormal date. Finally, a dating friendship site to meet others with similar interest. Find your match that shares an interest in the paranormal, science, life after death, ghost stories, Bigfoot, UFOs, alternative medicine, conspiracy theories. Paranormal Date now has over 55,000 members, and it's completely free to check out. Right now, just use the promo code GEORGE, 40% discount. Paranormal Date is also available free on iOS, Android apps. check out the new companion site when you're over there. It's called conspiracydate.com. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. Our guest, Ralph Ellis. We're discussing alternative history, Jesus, and how this ties into King Arthur. Well, you're going to find out next. This is Coast to Coast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. And hey, I'm impressed. The Coast family, the Coast audience, you guys are musical pillars of knowledge, because we've got You Versus Yesterday, Ed Rudnicki, Willpower Radio, Senor Bone, Huggy Byer, Maria, Rebel Scum came in at the end here with Phantom Planet. There you go. Well done. That's a song of theirs called California. All right, let's get back to Ralph Ellis. Ralph, one of the points that you had made right before the break is we started to bring up Freemasons. And I know that there are a lot of religious researchers and scholars out there that are listening to this show that are starting to blow a couple of fuses. They need to just hang with us here and go through the research. But mentioning Freemason right now at this stage of the game, and the disciples too as well, calling them Masons, is pretty heavy. So where does this evidence come from?
Well, it's just simply from the New Testament. Well, you know, I am a Mason myself, so I understand the structures of Masonry. And it's just fairly clear to me that the system they ran within the Nazarene Ebionite Church of Jesus and James is very, very similar to the Masonic system. And we have this also from the Templar system as well, where the rules of the Templar sect were exactly the same as the group that was down on the Dead Sea there. They had the Jewish sect on the shores of the Dead Sea, and if you look at their rules and regulations, it looks like the Templars simply took that and took that for their own. And so the Knights Templar were running the same system. They were all called the Poor. So they were called the Poor. The Ebionites were called the Poor. The Church of Jesus and James was called the Poor. And the Knights Templar were called the Poor as well. They were the Poor Knights of Christ, and they followed in the same footsteps. And we even get much later in the modern era, we have the Poor Knights. I'm not sure if you have those over there. It's French toast, we call it, the Poor Knights.
Right.
Which is bread that's battered and baked on both sides. And that is Jacques de Molay. That's where it came from, because Jacques de Molay was battered and he was grilled on both sides. He was the master of the Templars when they were disbanded in 1307, when they were attacked by the Catholic Church.
Hence the name French toast, right?
He became French toast.
He became French toast. Now, we have a couple of other things in the historical narrative here that I want to tie together. First, we have Edessa, and then we have Mary and Martha. And we have Palmyra and the other communities, cities around Jerusalem. And then, of course, Cairo and what was going on over in the Nile Valley. So let's address all of these really quick before we get to the bottom of the hour. This is very important.
Yeah. Well, I suppose the question is, where did these people come from? Where did this royal family come from? Because Jesus was a part of a royal family. He was a king. He's called a king on 36 occasions, I think, in the New Testament.
Right.
But that's just not symbolic. He was a real king. But the question is then, where did this king come from? I think we've got time to go through this, but my research takes him all the way back to Caesar and Cleopatra back in 43 BC. When Caesar was killed in Rome on the Ides of March, Cleopatra was pregnant. And we have this from Cicero, because he's very alarmed, because he doesn't want an heir of Caesar to become the next emperor of Rome.
Right.
And then after a few months, he's happy because the crisis is over. Why did the crisis pass? Well, because, well, he thought that maybe Cleopatra might have a miscarriage. But I think that she probably had a daughter, and a daughter could not become the next emperor of Rome. And so we don't hear anything more about this child, this lost child of Cleopatra, until about 20 years later, when it was Augustus Octavian was sorting out his borders. And he gave to Juba II, he was the king of North Africa, of Mauritania, and he gave him the daughter of Cleopatra, who was called Cleopatra Selene. And then he went to his eastern borders, to the fearsome Parthians, they call them, the Persians, who were the dreaded enemies of Rome. They'd already had several battles and lost several battles with Phraates IV. And what does he give Phraates IV? He gives him a courtesan, a prostitute. And you've got to start thinking to yourself, no, that wouldn't work. You know, if he had given Phraates IV a prostitute, he would have declared war. But no, Phraates IV was so impressed with his new wife, he made her his chief wife. And her name was Queen Thea Musa Aurania, one of these lost characters that nobody seems to know about, because a lot of this history was all covered up. In fact, most listeners probably haven't heard anything to do with Edessa and all the characters we're going to talk about, because they were all covered up. And the initial cover-up was by Josephus Flavius, the Jewish historian. Because if you go through his books and you type in Edessa and you type in the monarchy from Edessa, they just don't exist. They're not there, because he's deleted them all and changed their names. So anyway, we ended up with this queen in Persia, who I say is the daughter of Queen Cleopatra. So she has an Egyptian heritage, and there's good reason for thinking that. And she was also related to Caesar as well. But anyway, she is the queen of Persia for 20 years, and then she gets thrown out of Persia. They upset the Persians, and she gets thrown out. And so they make their way with 200 courtiers, I think they had, and 600 cavalry they took with them, so they didn't go out just on their own.
Right.
And they ended up going back west and going back to Syria. So now we have the nativity story, because we have this very strange nativity story where we have a prince and a king, because Jesus was a king. Why is he being born in a stable and not in a palace?
Why?
And well, yeah, and of course, this is how they try and make out that they were carpenters and they were poor and all the rest of it, and this is why they were only in a stable. But no, he was a king. Well, now we have the story, because now we have this monarchy on the move from Persia. They've just been kicked out of Persia, traveling to Syria in AD 4. This all happened in AD 4, just at the right time. And they would not have had a palace. So it doesn't matter how rich they were, they didn't have a palace, so they would have been sleeping wherever they were. And obviously they were in some sort of small hotel, small stable sort of affair. And the main thing about it, I suppose, is that if they had a child being born at that time, in the Jesus story, he was visited by the three kings, which are, you know, the three magi. And the magi, the three kings, are the magi from the priests from Persia.
Right.
Now, why would the priesthood of Persia be interested in a Judaic birth in Syria in AD 4?
In a manger, right.
In a manger. It doesn't make any sense. But now we have the reason why they would have been interested, because this character was actually a prince of Persia. He had just come out of Persia. His father was Phraates IV, or his grandfather, whichever it was. He was technically a prince of Persia, even if he was being born in Syria in a state of some poverty in a stable. So, of course, the Magi would have been interested in him, the Persian priesthood, because he was a prince of Persia. So here we have the nativity scene, and at last we can start explaining all of these aspects of the gospel story that didn't make any sense before. And this is what I sort of like about my work. You come across these coincidences, and you start to explain things, and then it starts to explain things that were totally inexplicable before.
And then you have, somebody is going to hit me shortly with, wait a minute, church, what about the crucifixion? Well, what about the crucifixion, Ralph?
Yeah, well, this child ended up in Edessa. So when they went to Syria, he became the king of Edessa. Now, Edessa has been deleted, as I say, from history, and so you can't find it in the books of Josephus. But there is a comparison to be made between Edessa and what he calls Adiabeni. And so this king of Adiabeni and Edessa, they were the kings who started the Jewish revolt. And so we're coming back to the AD 60s again, AD 68, AD 70, the Jewish revolt.
That's right.
And it was these kings who started the Jewish revolt. It was the kings of Edessa. Now, after the Jewish revolt, because we can go perhaps through this in more detail later, but after the Jewish revolt, they lost the Jewish revolt against Commander Vespasian, against the Romans. Josephus, he was coming back from Tekoa, which is Herodium, just south of Jerusalem, and he saw the three leaders of the Jewish revolt, the Edessan kings, being crucified in the Kidron Valley, just outside Jerusalem. And so he petitioned the governor, who was Titus at the time, and he got the three leaders taken down from the cross. And they were given medical attention. Two of them died, and one of them survived. Familiar story? Yeah, of course it's a familiar story, because this is the crucifixion scene. And the person who took the kings down from the cross was called Josephus. Josephus of Arimathea. Yeah, because not only does it fit in this circumstances, but when we go into Arthurian legend, which we'll do shortly, it fits in Arthurian legend as well, because Arthurian legend says the very same thing, that Joseph of Arimathea was Josephus Flavius. And that's a bit heretical as well. In fact, all of this gets a little bit heretical, because it changes the character of Josephus Flavius. Sorry, it changes the character of Joseph of Arimathea quite substantially.
Now, of course, really quick, before we get to the break, because when we come back, we're going to jump into the Arthur side of things. During this crucifixion scene that Josephus is referring to, two of the kings or leaders of the revolt died, one lived. Where was Mary at this point? And for that matter, where was Martha?
Yeah, Mary and Martha. Well, Mary and Martha, the Bethany sisters, one of them, Mary, of course, is Mary Magdalene, one of the Bethany sisters. And their life changes considerably as well in this story, because, and this isn't just my research, this comes from Professor Robert Eisenman. In his huge great books he wrote about James, the brother of Jesus, he went through it and he proved that Mary and Martha, the Bethany sisters, were Mary and Martha Bothus. And I congratulated him on this. I wrote a little email, and he said, no, they weren't really exactly the same people. They just based the life of the Bethany sisters on Mary and Martha Bothus.
And
I'm thinking, hold on.
Yeah, right. Well, and with these sisters came money. I mean, big money. This was a rich, rich family, and it fits into the classic narrative in the Bible about Mary, you know, being the funder of the funder, not the thunder, but the funder of his teaching and what he was doing at that time.
Yeah, which is exactly what it says. And this is why Professor Robert Eisenman couldn't link the two and say they were the same, because A, they were too rich, and B, it puts the story in the 1860s again, because Mary and Martha Bothus lived in the 1860s. They were 1860s characters. And more than that, I suppose, they were the richest women in Judea. That's what it says in the Talmud. So a lot of this history about them comes from the Talmud. And the Talmud says that Mary Bothus, this is Mary Magdalene, she had a dowry of 1 million gold denarii, 1 million gold coins in the first century.
Yeah, 1 million of anything gold is a lot of gold, Ralph.
Yeah, it's a lot of gold. And who was she marrying? Well, she was marrying Jesus. That's what it says in the Talmud. Jesus of Gemala, who I have previously already identified as being the biblical Jesus. And who marries Jesus of Gemala? Well, it's Mary Magdalene marries him. And this 1 million dowry gold price, I worked it out in just straight gold terms, because it comes out at about 7 tons of gold. I mean, we're talking an awful lot of gold here.
Right.
It comes out at about $280 million, I think it is, in gold terms. But then I thought, hold on a minute. Gold hasn't held its value here. So let's work this out in the terms of the wages of Roman soldiers. So I worked it out in terms of wage money, and it came out to, I think it was $20
billion. $20 billion, an extraordinary pile of money, right?
Yeah.
And now with Talmud, how much can we depend on it for accuracy?
Well, I think it's actually a very good record, because most of this was written in the first century. Now, if you go onto Wiki and have a look at the Talmud, it'll say it was written in the fourth century. But most of what it's talking about was written by Yohanan ben Zakkai. And Yohanan was a first century high priest of Jerusalem after the Jewish revolt. And a lot of it is his sayings and what he thinks about, you know, the politics and history at that time. So a lot of this Talmud is first century. And I cannot believe that someone like Yohanan ben Zakkai was not writing it down at the time. You know, this idea that it was an oral history just doesn't gel with me, because, you know, the Jews wrote everything down. I mean, you've only got to look at Josephus Flavius in his enormous great Antiquities, which is his version of the Old Testament.
Okay, let me jump in there, Ralph. We've got to take a network break right here. But if the audience thinks that this might be heretical, next, as we deal with King Arthur, we're taking it to a whole nother level here on Coast with Ralph Ellis. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. We'll be right back. Stay with us.